I Want to Hold Your Hand by Flippy Spoon. Read by Cookie Mom 6067. Chapter 1. A Bad Idea. This is a disaster, Jim thought. The moment he materialized on the Ferragus transporter pad, Jim experienced a spike of anxiety like he hadn't felt in years. He was not an anxious person. He prided himself on his ability to keep a cool head in dire situations. The last time he'd felt anything similar had been in the aftermath of Tycho 4. And even then, it had taken a Starfleet counselor with the determination of an angry Klingon to get him to talk about it for an hour. Jim took a deep breath and stepped down off the pad where Lieutenant Reyes was manning the console. "Kirk," Reyes said, nodding curtly. "Good to see you. Captain Lula is waiting in the conference room to brief you." "Thanks, Reyes." "Straight to business." Kirk shouldered his bag all the way through the narrow and dimly lit corridors of the Farragut to the conference room just behind the bridge. The light that had been flickering in the bridge corridor when Kirk had left was still flickering. The conference room seemed smaller than it had before Kirk had visited the Enterprise. "Jim?" Lula smiled tightly, which was about as friendly as things got around the Farragut. "Good to see you. I know this is all rather abrupt. Consider it a compliment." Lula spoke from his seat at the table, where the security chief, science officer, engineering chief, and a few lieutenants Jim knew closely were waiting. Minutes ago, Jim had been dancing with Spock. He dropped his bag and took a seat, folding his hands in his lap under the table because they were shaking, and he did not know why. "I do, Captain. Now tell me what I'm getting into." 3 years ago, Starfleet took pity on the pre-industrial people of Felner II and installed a giant drill in an uninhabited section of their planet. The purpose, to geothermal energy enough to warm it to a temperature conducive to survival, though half of the planet is still wretchedly cold most of the year. Now that the climate has stabilized in some regions, formerly iced over rivers have melted, pastures have greened, that means the population is taken to migration, as populations are wont to do. The drill must be moved again. That was going to be the mission, an important but not immediately urgent mission. Then the drill shut down completely in the closest Starfleet outpost, which periodically observes Felner II, to make sure things are going smoothly, does not know why. "So we're moving the drill," Kirk said. "Moving it, starting it back up," Lula's science officer, Commander Zheng, agreed. "And investigating the cause of its shutdown, if at all possible. We're looking at severe weather. This mission will be difficult. That's why we needed you on the job, Commander." Jim almost looked over his shoulder to make sure Zheng was not addressing someone else, and the captain seemed to recognize his surprise. "Got a new stripe for you, Kirk," Lula said. "Soon as you get back from here. But why stand on ceremony? If anything, I need you to hold that authority right now, so let's say that rank up is as good as done." "Yes, sir," Jim said. "Thank you." This was what he was made for, Jim thought. This was what he was good at. So why did it feel like the walls were caving in? Still, he'd always been great at compartmentalization. Probably one reason he got along so swimmingly with Spock, after all. Jim acknowledged the mounting causeless panic and set it aside, focusing only on the mission and the captain's briefing. They were to transport down in only 30 minutes. Jim had just enough time to drop his stuff off at his quarters and get into gear. The meeting was brisk and to the point. But just before the captain could call it, Jim said, "Captain, I'd like to stop by sick bay for a minute before we transport." Everyone looked at him with alarm. "Are you sick, Jim?" The captain frowned. "It's nothing," Jim assured him. "Pike keeps his silver lady like a meat locker. Think I caught a cold is all. Just need a hypospray and I'll be right as rain." "That's fine then," Lula said, visibly relieved. "You can meet our new doc while you're at it. Just be quick." The fact that he was lying did not escape Jim. It just did not seem like an act befitting his new station to take the time to explain that he'd just partaken in a Vulcan sex marathon and was feeling some kind of emotional side effect in the aftermath. A doctor, however, was sworn to confidentiality unless he could not fulfill his role, and Jim certainly could. that made him feel a little better about things. Until he met the new doctor. "It's just a little anxiety," Jim said, narrowing his eyes. He over-enunciated, as the new guy did not seem to be hearing him, his big buggy blue eyes laser-focused on his medical tricorder. "That's it." "Yeah, I heard you the first time, sonny boy," the doctor said. "I'm saying if it's severe enough that you're asking for meds, I'd like to get you checked out on your return from Fellner 2. And you're lucky I don't ask the captain to take you off this mission altogether. Your heart rate is accelerated and your blood pressure is too high. What part aren't you understanding?" Jim did not like the idea of having to explain anything on his return. He felt as if he had a great secret he was driven to protect. He could practically hear Spock's voice in his head telling him it wasn't logical. Spock. Spock, Spock, Spock. He clenched his fists. Spock was supposed to be here, with him by his side. Nausea rolled through his stomach and he took a deep breath. "This is ridiculous. I'm a professional. I can handle missing my new boyfriend." "What's your name again?" Kirk said. "Dr. Leonard McCoy," the doctor said for the second time, "at your service. Anything hinky happen on the Enterprise you want to tell me about? Please remember, doctors do talk to each other. I can call up Dr. Mbenga anytime I like. In fact, Joe owes me a bottle of Saurian brandy over a poker game. So don't you lie to me, kiddo." "I fucked a Vulcan so hard we astral projected ourselves into space." Jim calculated that if he told this, McCoy, about the lie of the virus on Cutlera, he might hold him back from the mission, thinking he was still sick. Whether Mbenga would tell McCoy about the Ponfar incident, he was not certain, but either way, a convincing enough lie now would get him on the mission he was certain he was well enough to accomplish. "Okay, Doc," Jim said, nodding. "Well, I'm not a kiddo. I'm actually the first officer of this ship now, so you can call me Commander Kirk. Nothing happened on the Enterprise. I'm just a little anxious, and I'd like an anti-anxiety med for the mission. I'll be happy to go under your bone saw as soon as I return. Talk to Mbenga all you like. We good now?" "Bone saw?" McCoy rolled his eyes and he crossed to a medicine cabinet to load a hypospray. "I like that one. Haven't heard it before." He stuck Jim in his shoulder. "I'll give you 2 extra hypos just in case you need it. And when you come back, I get the feeling we're going to be having words again, Commander." Jim took the extra hypos and hopped down off the bio bed, tossing the doc a sardonic salute. "I just bet, Dr. Bonesaw." "Hey now, I, for one, don't need formality in this med bay," the doctor called after him. "You can just call me Bones." "Oh, Christ, it's fucking cold," Jim thought. By this point in his admittedly short but accomplished career so far, Jim had been on 1 or 2 difficult missions. But landing in the unpopulated wastes of the northern region of Fellner 2 and disembarking from the shuttle only to be punched in the face by a needle-sharp snowy wind on top of his increasing unease really took the cake. Of course, they were all outfitted in extreme weather gear, and Jim hurriedly pulled his goggles down over his eyes, tugging his balaclava into place. Like the other 3 members of the away team, his skin was covered head to toe. It had been uncomfortable on the shuttle, but now Jim was only grateful. Mercifully, they'd landed near the drill, sitting dormant atop a sizable rig. The drill was actually a spinning laser. Every 3 months, the observation outpost remotely moved the drill to a new location within the perimeter of this northern region to drill a new hole. So far, 12 holes in the current location were tagged with red flags speared through the snow. While the drill's previous home, further south, had released enough energy to turn a few icy areas much more temperate, hence the migration. The drill was now located in a climate that had heated enough to go from instant icy death to merely viscerally unpleasant. Problem being, the drill had shut down. They would need to move it anyway, yet it was strange that it had abruptly stopped drilling. That it had shut down entirely was stranger. None of the populace had yet migrated this far. Who would have tampered with it? The drill's computer system had complex maintenance systems and backstops. Jim knew a little, by his own estimation, about its mechanics, but that was a problem for the engineer on this mission. "I'm freezing," Lieutenant Goodman yelled through his balaclava. Goodman was twice Jim's size, and even he looked like the cold was really getting to him. "Even in this gear, it's freezing." Jim slapped Goodman on his broad back, hardly feeling his hand hit through his thick gloves. "Let's get these readings, then we can get back to the shuttle lickety-split. Sound good?" The plan was unavoidably wonky. They needed to take readings of the surrounding area, then power the thing back up and upload all data activity preceding its shutdown. The rest of the mission depended on what they discovered. "Aye, sir," Goodman said, as the two of them trudged through the knee-deep snow, followed by Lieutenant Jimenez from the Science Division and Lieutenant Javel from Security. Just taking a step took a whole half minute, and it was difficult to get a clear line of sight through his goggles. Jim focused on taking one step at a time. Get to the drill. Get the readings. Power up the drill. Upload data. Still, it was difficult to even think about that when the force of the snow struck him like tiny knives, the Starfleet gear seeming perhaps not enough up to the severity of the weather. His joints ached and every limb was increasingly frigid. The area they were moving the drill to would not be any more inviting, and actually setting the rig up once they, hopefully, fixed whatever was wrong would be a pain and a half. "I wish Spock was here," Jim thought. Then all at once he was overwhelmed with a wave of longing so intense that it brought him to his knees in the snow. His head throbbed. He was suddenly very weak. "Commander," Ensign Javel appeared, helping him to his feet. "Are you all right, sir?" "Yes," Jim lied, "just stumbled for a second." He could hardly breathe. Dr. McCoy's hypo had helped for a short period, and now its effects were completely absent. Jim took a deep breath and soldiered on. "This is not normal," Jim realized. "What is happening to me?" Jim met Goodman at the rig, and the four men crowded inside the rig's narrow compartment, sheltering the console and data banks. He found himself more useful in powering the computer back up than he'd imagined. Together, they accessed the data banks and uploaded all activity for the last 3 months into their tricorders while studying what information flowed across their screens. "Right there," he said, just as Goodman chirped an exclamation. He pointed to the spike in energy across one of the data bank's records. The spike repeated and grew larger. It wasn't coming from the drill. "What is that?" "Whatever it is, it peaked just before the shutdown," Goodman said. He scanned to the end of the readout, and sure enough, the mysterious energy reading coming from outside the drill spiked just before the drill's activity took a sharp drop, and the readout ended entirely because the entire thing had powered down. "Maybe we'll see whatever that is in the environmental readings," Goodman said. "Javel and Jimenez, start environmental readings to the north and south of the perimeter," Jim ordered when they'd headed back outside. "I'll take the east and west." It took all his energy just to stay on his feet and give orders through the roar of the snow and his balaclava. He was lightheaded when he'd finished speaking. In retrospect, it had been a terrible mistake not to report what had felt like very mild symptoms of nothing in particular to McCoy, as sensible as his choices had seemed at the time. But it was too late for apologies now. For the good of the mission, he'd have to power through. If he collapsed or something, they'd just beam him back. They'd only taken the shuttle in order to eventually tow the drill and rig. While finishing up his readings, hardly able to read his tricorder through the blur of whipping snow, his limbs aching from the cold and his stance unsteady, Jim was so overcome with an onslaught of emotion he began to cry behind his goggles. It took far too much energy and concentration to finish the task and make his way back to the shuttle, trudging through the knee-deep snow as he sniffed, reaching under his goggles to wipe away tears, at least with the goggles no one would notice. Back in the sanctity of the sealed shuttle, however, he had no reason to wear his goggles. Embarrassed, Jim stepped back into a shadow, putting on a pretense of leaning against a bulkhead as the three other members of the away team studied the data on their tricorders. Overcome, Jim zoned out long enough that he startled when Goodman grabbed his shoulders, a crooked frown fixed between the goggles on his forehead and the balaclava pulled down under his chin. "Commander Kirk," Goodman said firmly. Sir, you with us? Shit. How long had Goodman been talking? Yeah, yes. Kirk shook himself. Sorry, could you repeat that? He saw Javel and Jimenez exchange surprised looks, but Goodman just said, it's that cold, you know, gets in your head. We were just about to go over the environmental data here. Jim nodded, rallying, and they crowded around their collected tricorders. There it is, Jim muttered, pointing at his own screen. This unknown energy reading, it's coming from below the surface. Jimenez, what do you make of it? It could certainly be something affecting the drill, Jimenez said. Difficult to confirm without a real investigation, which will be arduous under these conditions. Goodman grunted in frustration. Okay, but if we move that whole thing and then it shuts down again in its new location. Right, Kirk sniffed. His eyes were watering again. His heart ached in his chest, and worst of all, his head was throbbing. He blinked back tears again, clearing his throat. Given the urgency here, I think our best bet is to do readings on the drill's new location before we move it. If we get similar readings, we may want to reevaluate. If we don't see those energy readings, then we move it and then study the upload from the rig. Could be the shutdown is a glitch in the drill's computer. I think that makes sense, Goodman said. Shouldn't take more than an hour to transport, get the readings, and get back here. Won't be any more fun where we're going, I'm afraid, Kirk said, sighing. In fact, it'll be worse. Can't wait, Javel muttered, and tossed Kirk a little salute. I'm going to assume your enthusiasm is genuine, Ensign, because we're burning daylight, Jim said. Goodman, back me up at the con. Yes, Commander. The trick was staying clear of any populated areas while taking the fastest route. Jim congratulated himself by finding a shortcut to the northwest region by flying along a nearby lake. If they kept to the west side of the lake, they could avoid being spotted by the villagers on the east side. Probably. He congratulated himself a second time for sneaking a second anti-anxiety hypo without anyone noticing. Playing it a little fast and loose, aren't you, Commander? Goodman said, raising his eyebrows as Kirk punched in navigation. Who, me? Kirk said, smiling lopsidedly. Just trying to avoid this taking 3 hours instead of one. Plus, I'd be surprised if a couple of villagers seeing a gray blip in the sky for a second throws their entire civilization out of whack. They'd probably just think it was a weird bird. But don't tell the captain I said that. The storm hit just before they reached the lake. What the hell is that? Javel said, fastening his seatbelt as the shuttle was tossed violently for a third time. Kirk was knocked against a bulkhead and his head rang. If it's an ion storm, sure came the hell out of nowhere. He clenched his jaw, standing and clutching the console. I'll try compensating with inertial dampeners. Ah! The shuttle tumbled and he was thrown backwards along with Goodman. It felt as if a giant was shaking them around like beans in a can. Gotta be an ion storm, Jim said. He'd fallen back against Javel. He fought to get back on his feet and over to the console. Goodman, get on those inertial dampeners for me. I'm trying, Commander. Goodman grimaced, his hands flying over the controls. Jim didn't see the hatch blow open, but he sure felt it, the force of the wind's current pulling him back as he held on to a handle in the bulkhead, while beside him Jimenez, caught out with nothing to hold on to, went sliding back on his boots. Jim lunged for him, keeping one hand gripping the back of his seat and caught his arm. Hold on, Jim shouted. He had a solid hold on Jimenez, their arms linked. He shouted back at Goodman. The hatch is still attached. Can you close it? Controls aren't responding, Commander, Goodman said. Fuck. Okay, one thing at a time. Jimenez, get in his seat, fasten up. I'll help you close the door, Jimenez said. I'll close the door. You get in your seat and fasten that belt. Yes, sir. Jimenez managed to pull himself into a seat, and Jim licked his lips, resisting the terrible pull of the wind as the ship tumbled about. Javel had made it to a seat and fastened his belt, and Goodman seemed secure at least. There was a manual lever. Jim held on tight, one arm wrapped around the back of his seat as he reached over to make a grab. Wish Spock was here. Wish Spock was here. Wish Spock was here. Wish Spock was... Then the shuttle went turning end over end, and he lost his hold, flying out of the hatch and tumbling down to a sprawl of blue. The water might as well have been a cement wall the way it hit him, and before everything went dark, he thought, "Spock, I'm so sorry." And several light years away, Spock began to scream. Chapter 2, A New and Tender Thing. Spock realized they'd both made a terrible mistake the moment Jim shimmered away from the transporter pad. It began as a causeless sense of unease that surpassed a simple emotional response to Kirk's abrupt absence. Spock returned to his quarters. He was meant to be resting up. Yet, he found now he could not sleep at all. In fact, he could hardly sit still, filled suddenly with the terrible restlessness that had him pacing. If this was another bit upon far aftermath, it was nothing he'd yet heard of. The most disturbing part to Spock's mind was how long it took him to realize he should meditate, which was 47 minutes. Meditation did not help. However, in sorting through his turbulent emotions, which were entirely centered around Jim Kirk, he managed to locate within his mind something entirely new. Something raw throbbed within his mind. It was painful, yet precious. Like a crying infant requiring care it was not receiving. The discovery rocked him. Spock opened his eyes, breaking out of his meditation. Short of breath, he stumbled to his feet. Could it be? No, surely not. Spock's hand shook as he typed out the message to Sodun. The controls he'd been promised would return with the end of his Ponfar seemed yet further out of reach. It took great concentration just to write out something coherent. Avoiding any explicit details, he summarized his time with Jim. He found himself waxing rather poetic on the extent of their compatibility. He attempted a vague description of their stranger experiences and the hallucinations they'd experienced in the end. Yet, that too was difficult. He felt an overpowering need to protect what he'd shared with Jim, even beyond the normal tendency among Vulcans to remain private about such things. Spock broke off the summary in the middle and pounded out his feelings along with a brief description of the presence in his mind. Unfortunately, Lieutenant Kirk was forced to transport back to his ship sooner than planned on a mission of some urgency. Since his departure, I have experienced a strong sense of anxiety and an almost existential trauma, a sense of terrible loss, or rather, a perhaps impending loss I must prevent. I am uncertain. The emotions are chaotic and difficult to describe, much less contain. As previously mentioned, Jim and I discovered a mutual romantic interest we wished to pursue going forward. Yet, this emotional response feels much different than simply missing a romantic partner. There is a new presence in my mind, too. Something unbearably tender, but not like a wound. I must care for it. I must encourage its growth. Yet I am unable. Spock paused, his hands hovering over his keyboard. He could hardly breathe. He started the same question over and over, erasing it, rethinking it, certain he must be mistaken. He pursed his lips and typed it out again. Have we created a bond? Spock sent the message before he could think about it. Yet when he got to his feet, a wave of dizziness came over him that made him sit down again. Sodun, he hoped, would not take too long in responding. Ah! He clenched his teeth and grabbed his head with both hands. Pain had set in right behind his eyes, pulsing with the beat of his heart and the rush of his blood. His door pinged and he ignored it, his stomach roiling. Spock? Christine's voice rang out. Sorry to bother you. I heard you might be awake, so enter. Spock croaked. His quarters looked blurry. Christine walked in, already talking, pacing back and forth, and therefore not looking at Spock. I'm sorry, really, I know you need to rest. I've just been worried about you, and she sighed, shaking her head. I miss when we were friends, you know, before. And now I'll be leaving soon for the fellowship, and I just want to know if we're still friends, and that you're okay. We are friends, Spock choked out. Perhaps it was the sound of his voice that made Christine look at him in alarm. But, oh my God, what's the matter with you? She rushed to him, kneeling in front of his chair. I am not okay. Your brain activity is erratic, Mbenga said, frowning. My brain is hurts. He could hardly keep his eyes open. The glassy, stark whiteness of the sick bay pained his eyes, compounding the headache. Just then, a hypo spray stung his neck, and a moment later, the pain was significantly muted, though not completely absent. Better. Oh, he is in bad shape if he's saying things like, my brain is hurts. Christine grimaced, staring at her medical tricorder. Heart rate is high, even for a Vulcan. If this is some sort of come down from Ponfar, I don't know about it, Mbenga winced, suddenly realizing he was speaking in front of Chapel. Spock felt mortification, as a terrible flush all over him, and he sighed. Yet he did not feel the same sense of shame about it as he had at the beginning of his time. I suppose total confidentiality hardly matters now, Spock muttered. But let us keep this within sickbay at least, Dr. Mbenga. Yes, I apologize, Mr. Spock, Mbenga said. I am unused to keeping things from Nurse Chapel. Christine looked back and forth between them, squinting. What in the heck is Ponfar? I will explain later, Mbenga said. Suffice it to say, it is what he quarantined with Lieutenant Kirk to take care of, and we thought it would be taken care of. I felt it end, Spock muttered, but if only Jim were here. A tidal wave of emotion rolled over him, and he turned his head, unable to hide the tear that slid down his cheek. Oh, Spock, Chapel murmured and clutched his shoulder. Blood pressure is plunging here. But what? Mbenga pressed. Spock swallowed. Reflexively, he attempted to exert his controls, but they were all in shambles. I believe Jim and I may have inadvertently formed a mating bond. If so, that would complicate matters. I have written to the healer referred by my mother to ask his advice. If you have formed a mating bond, Mbenga said firmly, you should not have been separated so soon after its formation. I realize that. Spock shut his eyes again. I did not know such bonds could form without intention, Mbenga said, stroking his chin. Neither did I. Experimentally, Spock thought of Jim, visualizing his face, his bright eyes, his knowing smile, and the way it could suddenly turn either mischievous or so warm it seemed to glow. That helped a little. I'm going to give you a mild sedative, Mbenga said. Wait, no, wait. Just to calm you down for a moment, Mbenga insisted. Nurse Chapel, will you fetch his pad from his quarters? If this healer responds, I want you to know about it immediately. Of course, Christine said before jogging off. Mbenga hit Spock with the sedative and Spock relaxed, or at least his body did. His mind was still racing, unstabilized and terribly anxious. I need to find Jim. He felt like he was talking through sludge. Lieutenant Kirk is back on the Farragut, Mbenga explained, as if Spock might have memory problems, too. He didn't. Jim was likely already on some planet right now, barreling into danger. Thinking of it turned his entire body cold, and the onslaught of emotions returned. He gasped, tears rolling down his cheeks. I know, but I must find Jim. He must be here with me, Doctor. If this is a mating bond, M'Benga said, you are quite right. Suchin Tagai Spock, I am deeply concerned for your health and your mental well-being. The content of your previous communique describes to me a successful and satisfying ponfar, as well as the creation of an extremely powerful mating bond. To answer some of your questions, the out-of-body experiences you describe are not typical, nor are the hallucinations. A 12-hour period of continuing intercourse during ponfar is not dangerous, but certainly not typical. However, considering the compatibility of the mate as you describe it, as well as the burgeoning romance between you, I must conclude that you have managed to find something exceedingly rare. Spontaneous bond creation in such a circumstance, much less between a full human and someone of your genetic makeup, is an entirely unique occurrence. Spock, I must advise that you immediately reunite with your bondmate. It is both physically and mentally dangerous to be separated so soon after the creation of a mating bond. You require a minimum of 3 days together devoted entirely to settling into the bond. It must be allowed to begin growing properly. Additionally, if the two of you decide the bond should be severed, it should happen as soon as possible and with the aid of a healer. Please respond immediately. If required, I will speak to your ship's CMO or the captain to ensure they appreciate the urgency and seriousness of the situation. I would also relate to them that should you leave your ship to pursue your bondmate, the symptoms you are experiencing will begin to fade. The nearer you become to Lieutenant Kirk, the more your health and mental stability will improve. I should also note that Lieutenant Kirk is in as much danger as you are should you remain separated and is likely experiencing similar symptoms to your own. Healer Sodun. Spock could not bear to meet his captain's eyes. Finally, he glanced up and saw only sympathy and compassion, yet still his mortification and general emotional turmoil made him look away again. I apologize for the trouble I have caused, Captain, Spock said quietly. He remained on his bio bed, his hands in his lap, the captain seated at his side. The situation has already disrupted the ship's. Spock, shut your mouth, Captain Pike said. None of this is your fault. I hope you know by now how valuable you are to the ship and its crew, and to me, not just because you're one of the finest officers we have in the fleet, but because we happen to care about you as a person. We'll take care of you, Spock. We'll do whatever we have to do. But if you go apologizing for what you can't control again, we're going to have a problem. This galaxy is full of intelligent beings, and they all have different needs. There's nothing wrong with that. Infinite diversity, right? Yes, sir. It felt as if his heart had traveled up from just above his abdomen all the way into his throat. Thank you, Captain. Spock glanced at M'Benga and saw the way he was smiling approvingly. First things first, Pike said. We're going to turn right around and pursue the Farragut, and I'm going to get on the horn with Captain Lula. I don't know anything about Jim Kirk's mission right now, but hopefully we can get him back on his ship quick, get you two together again. If he's delayed on the planet, I must go and collect him, Spock said urgently. In your state? Pike said, his eyebrows jumping. Healer Sodun stated that my symptoms would improve the closer I get to Lieutenant Kirk. Spock sat up straight. He had to bite his tongue to prevent himself from pointing out that Jim was likely suffering too, and that was unacceptable, and he must go to him. Spock imagined their reunion. He visualized finding Kirk embracing him. Just the thought of it filled him with strength. That may indeed be preferable to waiting for others to find him first, if he is not on his ship by the time we are in transport range again. We'll see about that, Pike said, frowning. I may well need to speak to this healer, but first let's catch up with Jim's ship and let me explain things to Lula. Don't worry, I won't go into great detail about the Ponfar thing. Thank you, sir, Spock muttered. Pike returned to the bridge and Spock relaxed slightly, grateful when M'Benga went to his desk. Yet he found himself missing Nurse Chapel's presence when just like that she appeared again from her office, smiling tightly while handing him a mug. Feel like some tea? Yes. Thank you. Spock sat on the edge of the bio bed and took a long sip, finding the familiarity of his favorite tea calming. When did you eat last? She leaned against the bed, tapping her fingers. I do not think I can eat, he muttered. Do me a favor? Meal replacement drink? You can drink it in one go. Very well. Chapel crossed to the synthesizer and returned with a small cup, and Spock held his tea in one hand while drinking the entirety of the cup's contents. It was a little chalky, but otherwise not unpleasant. He handed her the cup again, and she nodded, satisfied. You know, I'm sorry for... She waved a hand. Coming in all full of my own stuff before. Meanwhile, you were suffering. There is no need to apologize, Spock said. You arrived just in time to come to my aid. I am grateful. Cool. Good. She nodded, tentative. I'll just leave you alone then. Please do not, Spock said. At her hopeful look, he felt a pang of regret. I, too, miss our friendship, and I do not want to be alone right now, unless you have other things to attend to. Nothing more important than this. She cast him a warm smile and sat in Pike's vacated seat. So in that case, why don't you tell me more about Sam's dashing brother who's apparently stolen your heart? He cheated the Kobayashi Maru? Christine gaped at him. The ship was headed to the Farragut as fast as was manageable. For that, Spock was grateful. Yet so far, his symptoms persisted. Apparently, the Academy was most impressed, Spock said, perhaps because he passed the test before taking the time to hack the program. Sounds like a real upstart, Christine said. I mean that in a good way. Yes, but compassionate, too, and... Spock lost his train of thought as a shudder ran through his body. Danger. Life-threatening danger. The pain meds were suddenly non-existent. His head throbbed and he clutched it, groaning. Oh, no, Jim. Christine's voice sounded far away. She was saying his name, yet he could hardly hear her. Muted sounds of the biobed beeping in alarm and then falling. A terrible vertigo came over him as if the ground had dropped out. Jim. Somebody somewhere was screaming in pain, and Spock trembled when he realized it was himself. Spock was crying, and he shut his eyes, clutching his head as if he might squeeze the pain out of his mind or reach inside to console the throbbing nub of their bond. Jim, my mate. My Tahila, hear me. I will find you. Stay Rishko, Tinash Ve'ashea. Stay alive, my love. Stay alive for me, and I will come for you. Chapter 3, The Yoke. Jim was warm. Jim was loved. He would never be alone again. Spock's hands were all over him as their lips met, palm to palm, body to body. Light encompassed them. They were inside each other, holding each other, so different and yet the same person. Ashayam, parted from me and never parted, never and always touching and touched. Jim. My mate, my Tahila, hear me. Spock. Jim woke up with a gasp. A sense of disorientation swept over him, and he clutched the thick straw mat beneath him, gaining his bearings as memories rushed back to him. The shuttle, his team, the mission. Spock. His head ached again. that was not as bad as it had been, which was good because he had no idea where he was. A small room in a clay-like structure lit by candles, spare but for his mat and a few cushions. Hot coals burned from a stone circle beside him, warming him. He was no longer wearing most of his gear, just the black field uniform worn underneath. Next to the straw mat, Jim found his communicator and he flipped it open, relieved. "That's right," a gravelly voice spoke from the shadows. Jim hadn't even noticed the figure sitting in the corner. "Just take a deep breath, good fellow. You will be well." An elderly man with gray-blue skin and wearing white fur skin pants and a leather tunic sat forward, appearing in the candlelight. He smiled at Jim. Or anyway, Jim thought he might be smiling. His thick lavender beard covered much of his mouth and chin, shaggy lavender hair falling to his shoulders. "Hello." Jim followed the man's advice and took a deep breath. "Hello." "Good thing the UT is still working." "How do you feel?" the man said. Jim thought about the question. He had fallen from the shuttle. He wasn't sure how far he'd fallen. Far, he was pretty sure. But then he'd hit the water. He remembered nothing after that. "Not good." "Not too awfully bad," he said warily. "Yourself?" "Just fine," the man said. "My name is Johnny. Welcome to the village of Radnar." "Radnar," Jim said, sitting up and crossing his legs under him. He was relieved to see the rest of his gear neatly folded and stacked in the corner. "Thank you. My name is Jim."
"Jim, yes, I know."
Johnny nodded, muttering it to himself.
"Jim, Jim, it is a good name. Feels good on the tongue. Jim, and your mate is Spock."
"What?" Jim stared at him. "What about Spock?"
"Apologies, good fellow Jim."
The man performed a little salute, touching two fingers to his head.
"You have been under the veil for some time."
"Under the veil?" He supposed Johnny meant he had been unconscious or just asleep. "How long?"
"We found you washed up on the shores of Lake Foam," Johnny said. "That was yesterday, around midday. And now it is dawn. I am gratified that you have awoken. You said the name Spock when you woke just now."
"I did, didn't I?"
"You said it many times from under the veil as well," Johnny went on. "And upon performing a reading, we discovered your yoke. So I must assume this Spock is your mate."
Jim pinched the bridge of his nose. "Well, now,
apologies again."
Johnny stood and crossed to a small table and pantry in the corner.
"You must be hungry and thirsty."
Jim could not dispute that. Johnny returned with the plate bearing something mashed and covered in a thin gravy with a side of a lentil-like beans and a cup of water. Jim mumbled his thanks and ate and drank, which did settle him. The mashed stuff really wasn't bad. His mouth was expecting potato, but it was more like a savory, mealy grain. The beans were better.
"Can you explain to me what a reading is?" Jim said.
"And also thank you for your hospitality, really. I'm not sure what happened, but I do know you saved my life."
"Of course."
Johnny tossed him that salute again.
"I have forgotten. You were born without. You may not know of readings."
"Born without?" Johnny tapped his head.
"Without sight into minds?"
"Oh, fuck, they're telepaths."
"I see," Jim said.
"And you read my mind while I was out?"
"It is a common practice among our people," Johnny said, a light reading, though we have never come across anyone like you. You must come from very far.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. Jim rubbed his eyes.
You have quite an imagination, Jim, Johnny said, hooting a laugh. Silver birds in the sky, beings I could not even describe, wonders. I wish I dreamed so. And your yoke, it is something very special, quite beautiful. I wept when I felt it. Curious that one born without should experience such a thing.
Right, the yoke, Jim said, cocking his head. I'm not familiar with the term yoke as you were using it.
Your yoke with your mate, Johnny said. Spock, the tie which binds, a bond. Myself and the elders I have consulted, we are concerned for you, Jim, that you should be parted from your yoked mate while the yoke is still so new. Just a fledgling seed in your mind. We thought something terrible must have happened to separate you at such a time and bring you to our shore. Thus we agreed that when you woke, we would do whatever we were able to reunite you with your mate.
The moment Johnny said the word bond, Jim's heart began to race. Jim only knew what Spock had told him about Vulcan mating bonds, which had been little. Spock had been bonded to T'Pring, and then they'd severed their bond, which was why he'd needed to take Jim as a mate for his Ponfar. But that didn't make them bonded, like Spock's parents were bonded. Did it? He trusted Spock. If Spock had known this was going to happen, he absolutely would have told Jim. But Spock had certainly not known everything there was to know about Ponfar either. That's why he had consulted the healer.
You were unaware of your yoke, Johnny said.
Yes, Jim whispered, but just hang on a minute. Jim closed his eyes and, having no idea just what he was doing, attempted to sense the bond. He breathed heavily, trying on a kind of half-assed meditation. Thoughts, feelings, his emotional turmoil, physical sensation, that throbbing, that slightly dulled pain. He wanted to avoid the pain, but something drew him nearer instead. He located it within his mind, and it burned to look at inside of himself. There it was, too tender to touch, but something which required protection and care. It was sore and raw. Yet despite that feeling, Jim did not imagine it as something made of flesh, not an organ and not a seed either. Jim imagined the birth of a galaxy, the gravity between them collapsing elements to form stars. The bond became so in his mind, worlds made from him and Spock, endless worlds to explore between them, formed from their own stardust. Something so powerful, it was actually cosmic. He could see it so clearly. He had felt it when they'd made love among those stars, transported. Jim opened his eyes and promptly choked on a broken sob.
Jim.
Johnny moved to sit next to him and patted his back tentatively. Jim dug his wrists into his eyes.
I am not usually so emotional, he mumbled. It's so beautiful, like feeling the sun for the first time. Oh, Spock.
It is common to feel strongly at the birth of a yoke, Johnny said. But this is why you must be reunited with your mate.
My mate, Jim said, as if trying on the word.
They had only decided to start dating, for crying out loud, and even that was inevitably long distance, and yet it felt so correct.
Spock is my mate, he said more firmly, wiping his eyes.
My bonded mate.
Yes, you're right. I do have to get back to him, but there is something I must do first. I was with others, three men. Then I fell into the lake. It's very important I get back to them, but thank you for your help, for showing me the yoke, and thank you for leaving my, he held up the communicator. Yes, your oracle. It made strange noises. We do not tamper with mysterious objects in Radnar. It never ends well, but it did make us curious about the people on the other side of the north. We hope to see that land someday, should the ice ever thaw. Yet if it does, the Palka may rise to the surface. They are dangerous beings, so perhaps we may never see beyond the north.
Hang on.
What's that about beings beneath the surface? Jim said.
And you say this guy is domesticated?
Jim grimaced as a six-legged white-furred beast knelt in the snow in front of him. The animal waited patiently as Johnny's elder friend Fafa handed over the reins.
Maybe I should try the communicator again.
He had tried the communicator a few times. Nothing doing. It occasionally emitted a squelch or a few snippets of broken-up speech, but Jim couldn't get through to anyone. He had to think it had been damaged in the ion storm, if not from his fall into the lake.
You will be fine, my friend, Fafa said, patting his shoulder. The Gallorp is very gentle. Only slap his flank if you want him to speed up. If you want him to stop, you say, Gow.
Gow, Kirk muttered. Got it. He climbed awkwardly astride the Gallorp. It did seem fairly serene, despite its broad, jowly face and protruding tusks. Johnny smiled, and Kirk held out his hand to hold his for a moment.
Johnny, thank you, good fellow, for all your help. You and your people are very kind.
We are gratified to have helped you, Johnny said, nodding.
Stay safe, Jim Kirk.
I hope you find Spock.
I will, thank you. Goodbye, Johnny. Goodbye, Radnar. Jim waved as Johnny and the small crowd of elders bowed. He lightly slapped the Gallorp's flank, and it took off with a lurch as Jim hung on for dear life in the direction of the northern region and the drill's original location. Whether the away team had moved it without him or not, it was far closer than the new location and a likely place for him to be found, but that was not his real purpose in returning there. The villagers of Radnar, and presumably neighboring villages, believed that a race of sentient beings lived beneath the surface of Felnor II, and blamed them for any number of events, from natural disasters to a cloudy day. The Palka had become a mysterious and frightening boogeyman for the people. Children often dared each other to dig deeper and deeper holes as a game, challenging the Palka to appear. Jim might have thought it was all primitive superstition before studying the environmental data. Now he wondered if the Palka did exist and had something to do with the unknown energy readings they'd found. What if the Palka had shut down the drill? It was worth investigating. Though he hoped his effort would be disrupted by contact with the Farragut, and more than that, though he was feeling marginally better since discovering the bond with Spock throbbing in his mind, he could not count on his own physical and mental stability. The cold didn't help either. It would be tricky to stay warm out there by himself with no shuttlecraft, even with all his gear on. But Johnny had given him a sack full of food and water, at least. If things got really bad, he knew he could at least return to Radnar and await rescue. Hopefully his separation from Spock wouldn't actually kill him. Jim had some experience riding horses back in Iowa, but it had been a couple of years, and Gallorps were a decidedly different experience. The ride was jolting, bouncing him around and not helping his headache. His thighs were sore as hell after a half hour of continuous riding, and then he had to stop after another half hour just to stretch his legs. He walked around a bit, and then sat in some chilly, dewy grass along the lake and tried meditating again. He located the bond and concentrated on it, thinking of Spock, finding peace. The peace did not last long, however, once he was back on the road. Jim found himself dry heaving, shutting his eyes as he clutched the neck of the Gallorp, eventually almost lying down upon its back, for he could not hold himself up for long. It was another 3 hours before he finally reached the drill, and once he'd arrived, he fell into a heap of snow, attempting a dismount. He sat, trembling and breathing deeply, before finally getting to his feet. Once he'd vaguely composed himself, he fed the Gallorp a bunch of black vegetables Johnny had given him as Gallorp food. It was something similar to a carrot, but thicker and wider. Jim shuddered. The snow was even thicker, whipping against his goggles. The visibility was terrible. The Gallorp seemed unbothered anyway. Johnny had assured him it could find its way home easily once it left Kirk. The drill had not moved. That was both good and bad to Jim's mind. Good if it meant the crew would return to this location. Bad because what had become of the crew? The ion storm may well have taken out the shuttle. His people could be dead or struggling somewhere in the wilderness. Best case scenario, their communicators were working. Perhaps they had beamed back to the Farragut and were deciding what to do next for both the drill and finding Jim. He tried his communicator several times along the way to no avail, nothing but squelch. The snow was up to Jim's thighs, and he staggered through it as he made his way to the rig, finding a bit of shelter in the console compartment. Briefly picturing himself holing up here for days if necessary, as he knocked snow from his boots, trying to keep the wet and cold outside rather than bringing it in with him. It was still not much of a shelter. It had no heating system and was made of metal, which would not help at all. Outside, the Gallorp took a nap, completely inured to the cold. Jim had to admit that his great plan was not much of a plan. He would power up the drill and hope it made the Palka do something if indeed they existed. He was really hoping they would show themselves. If not, well, he prided himself on his ability to improvise. Jim switched on the drill again, and then his eyes rolled back into his head as he collapsed to the hard metal floor. "Mr. Spock, sensor readings?" Jim was in the captain's chair, full bridge crew, Uhura at communications, Spock at his console. Jim was home. Everything was where it should be. And later, unless this weird thing on the view screen decided to attack the ship, Jim and Spock would have dinner and talk and play chess and eventually fall into bed after Spock inevitably looked at him across the chessboard with his smoldering gaze, following a day's worth of Jim's shameless flirtations. "An entity of unknown origin, Captain," Spock said, "emitting high levels of energy." "Do we know why it's appearing as a marbleized sphere?" "I cannot say, sir, though it is aesthetically most fascinating." Jim turned his head, smirking in Spock's direction just as he swiveled around his chair and raised his eyebrow. "Now, why did I know you'd say that, Mr. Spock?" "You have an extensive historical record of such interactions to glean from, Captain." "Now, Jim, get up. You must get up." Jim woke up wheezing. His eyes hurt, and that did not seem fair at all. His stomach was in terrible knots, and his head was full of that buzzy feeling again, as if the throbbing of the bond was complaining to the rest of his mind. Jim climbed to his feet and stared at the console, willing it to make sense. "If I'm usually at 100% capacity," he thought, "I'm probably at what? 30 right now? Actually, that might be generous. Nothing for it." He dug out some of the grainy mash stuff encased in a fruit skin that Johnny had given him, fully expecting it to come back up shortly, but maybe not. He drank some water, hoping that would help. Figuring out how to actually run the drill took longer than it should have. It was difficult to think clearly, but soon enough a deep and thundering hum sounded and a blue laser 2 meters around shot through the hole below the drill. "Okay," Jim muttered, "okay. Now we see, Mr. Spock. Now we'll just see what they do." Jim stood there, leaning heavily on the computer console, his entire body trembling. While he waited for something to happen, he ran a diagnostic on the drill. That took around 20 minutes, during which he was sure he was about to pass out again. It was difficult to think about anything but the throbbing bond, the galaxy birthed in his head that begged desperately for attention. The diagnostic completed, 100% working capacity. The drill's computer insisted that nothing was wrong with it. All at once, the drill stopped. The shutdown itself was curious. No warning at all. It just stopped.
"Daha!" Jim blurted. He clapped his hands. "Come on, suckers, where are you?"
Jim pulled his balaclava up over his nose and his goggles down over his eyes and trudged outside as he pulled on his glove.
"Hey, come on. Come on out. I know you're out there, Palka."
Kirk hollered into the snow, half delirious.
"Come on out. Come on. We got things to discuss here."
Then the ice and snow caved in beneath Jim, and the drill and both he and it were falling. Again, he was falling, 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 falling into the depths of Fellner 2.
Chapter 4, The Palka.
Jim felt like he was dead. The fall had not been so far. At some point, Jim hit ice, and then he was sliding, sliding, sliding through a series of tunnels, the drill having fallen over so that it got stuck halfway through the drill hole. Jim was not so lucky. He tumbled and slid and somersaulted down and down and down before finally coming to rest in an icy cavern. Jim laid where he was and caught his breath for a minute before finally emitting a soft, "Oof." The Gallorp, Jim was pretty sure, had not fallen. Jim hoped he was on his way back to Radnor. Meanwhile, Jim could not see his hand in front of his face. His communicator could emit a little light, and Jim felt around for it. Nothing. It had likely become detached in the fall. His tricorder had been left back in the shuttlecraft. Alone, in utter darkness beneath the planet's frozen surface, beat up and sick from Vulcan bondmate heartache, Jim rolled over on his stomach. His every limb was pained, and his head felt as if it might cave in, just as the ice had.
"Spock," Jim murmured, "I'm in a bit of trouble here."
He only hoped the rest of the away team was faring better. Jim crawled forward a bit and felt around. There seemed to be two tunnels branching off downward, which meant the other way would bring him back to the surface, if he could even make it back up there. He had fallen a long way and the ice was very slippery. Also, he had an inkling that the Palka had caused the cave-in and brought him down here deliberately. Whether their intentions were benevolent or not, he wanted to see his theory through. Had they heard him?
"Hey, Palka, or whatever you are,"
Jim tried to shout, and it came out more like a weak croak. Shakily, he started crawling towards the left tunnel into the darkness.
"Crawling to your death, genius," Jim thought.
Alone in the darkness and freezing cold, beat up and feeling like absolute shit besides that, with no way to contact anyone. And what would happen to Spock if his new bondmate died? He stopped crawling and shut his eyes.
"Spock, my love."
With his eyes shut, Jim sensed light suddenly and blinked. A small pink light had appeared in the cavern, flitting about in front of him like...
"Tinkerbell," Jim muttered.
The light flew in circles around his head, and then away into the rightward tunnel.
"Hey," Jim said, "come back, please."
The light returned and blinked at him, once, twice, and several times in succession.
"Are you trying to communicate?" Jim said. "I'm sorry. I don't speak fairy."
Blink,
blink, blink. Blink, 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 blink. The light disappeared down the tunnel again, and Jim followed.
Hope you're not the bad kind of fairy, Jim said under his breath. Wait up, will you?
Jim crawled and felt terrible and crawled. Then he felt worse and crawled. This is not the worst thing that's ever happened, he thought. It was an oddly comforting thought in times of duress. Yet he always managed to stop the thought there, letting mind and memory go further into the worst thing that had ever happened as far as his life went would not do him any good in this situation. Jim had to stop and dry heave more violently and painfully than he had yet before continuing on again. The light was patient. It flitted nearby, flickering in what Jim liked to think was a friendly manner.
You don't have a hypo spray for nausea and headaches on you, do you?
Jim croaked, wiping his mouth.
Oh, wow, that new doc's going to kill me if I don't die first.
Jim took a deep breath. His food and water had presumably fallen somewhere, too. He'd left the satchel on the floor of the rig. Jim wondered what Spock would be doing in this situation. Likely he would have managed to avoid falling through the ice. He certainly would not have dared mysterious subterranean creatures to show themselves either, Jim surmised. Well, live and learn. He was still hoping it would somehow end up being worth it.
I can't go any farther, Jim whispered.
His entire body was shaking, whether from cold or pain or general weakness, he wasn't sure.
I don't even know where I'm going.
The light danced in front of him, flew down the tunnel, and came back. It was clearly gesturing for him to follow.
Fuck.
Jim kept crawling. He was about to complain again when a tremor ripped through the tunnel, and then he was sliding out of control and then tumbling down into the darkness, the pink light following after him, flickering all the way. Jim somersaulted and landed on his back again. But he was no longer inside a narrow tunnel. He had arrived, it seemed, and landed at the entrance to a massive underground structure built into the ice. It was the size of a cathedral. It was full of steaming springs and stalactites. Jim could see it all because there was no longer just one little light. There were now thousands and thousands of lights filling the cavern. They were all different colors, and some much larger than his friend Tinkerbell. Jim wondered if Tinkerbell was a child of this race. He barely managed to sit up. He struggled to keep his sore eyes open. His lips were so chapped they hurt to move.
Are you all the Palka?
The lights spoke to his mind, all as one and all at once. It was excruciating. If Spock's mind had embraced him in the warm, sweet unfurling of his thoughts, the lights invaded, brutally, if not malevolently. It was immediately clear that they could not help their strength and did not intend to hurt him. He could feel that from them. Unfortunately, their intention did not lessen the pain, and Jim felt as if his mind was being cleaved in two. He could not help the scream he heard echoing all around him as he clutched his head in his hands.
We are the Palka. You are one of those puncturing. You must not puncture.
Jim had to concentrate very hard to respond.
You are hurting me. You are hurting my mind. Can we communicate without this pain?
We are unused to one as fragile as you. We have no other way to speak.
Ah,
Jim groaned, pressed himself into the ice as if it would help anything. He'd lost his goggles somewhere and his balaclava was gone, yet his face was now hot with tears and blood. Blood? But why was there blood? Oh, his nose was bleeding.
We were puncturing.
Jim thought carefully.
Because the planet has been cooling, and the people on the surface are going to freeze to death. We were releasing heat from the core. We didn't know you were here. We did not intend to harm you. The people on the surface, the Palka said, they are fragile, like you. Yes. You shut down our drill because we were harming you. Yes. We quieted the bad light that punctured. We sensed that you would puncture elsewhere, among other Palka, so we sent the storm.
Jim was crumbling quickly, but he was still certainly lucid enough to follow the conversation, and his mind reeled.
You sent the ion storm, Jim said. You do control the weather.
The people of Radnar had said as much, and Jim had put that down to primitive superstitions.
We can effect change on the surface and the weather of the planet. We have no interest in it except to defend ourselves. We remain below.
Stop. I must stop, please. Stop for a minute. Just a minute. I can't.
The lights broke out of his mind and Jim collapsed, sobbing into his hands. Yet it was a purely physical response. Even as he lay there, demolished, his thoughts raced. He wiped the blood from his nose and shuddered. There was an ambient noise in the chamber, like a soft roar of the snow above or of the ice settling, or perhaps the Palka possessed machinery somewhere. Even that was too loud now in Jim's wound of a mind. Yet just beyond that, and his own breath shakily steaming from his rough lips, Jim swore he heard Spock. It was so clear, he grunted, and looked around as if Spock might appear in front of him.
Jim, I am coming for you. Please hold on.
Okay, Jim whispered. He sat up and took a deep breath.
Okay, Palka. Speak to me again. Let's hash this out, but quickly.
The lights came rushing into his mind again, and it hurt no less. Jim cried out, agonized, but focused on the conversation.
If you have the ability to affect the climate, Jim said, could you warm the planet to make it hospitable to the fragile ones like me? Then we will not have to puncture any longer. We do not want to cause you any harm, but we are trying to help the people on the surface.
This is an agreeable compromise,
the light said. As quickly as he was able, because he wasn't, if he might actually be about to die if he continued, Jim wrapped up a couple of details. The Palka agreed to create a tunnel straight to the surface in case Starfleet wanted to send a telepath with a stronger constitution to communicate with them. Jim also informed them that an outpost close by would be observing the planet's climate. Both were important in case the Palka ended up making the climate too hot.
We are sorry to have caused you harm, the Palka finally said. Difficult to manage a single individual. But we may return you to the surface if you require it.
Great, Jim thought. Alone in the freezing cold, half dead. All he could hope was that Spock's voice in his mind had not been his imagination.
Yes, Jim thought. Thank you. Please, leave my mind now. I can't bear it.
Then the lights were gone, and Jim lay flat on his back, shuddering violently. The Palka, Jim thought, as he wavered in and out of consciousness, were pretty good with topography as well as climate. The ice all around him cracked from its surrounding surface,
becoming a column that began to rise. The lights flew up to the ceiling, creating a puncture of their own, a hole straight through to the surface. The column pushed through the hole, taking him up to the ground, a makeshift lift. And then, because Sepulchre had such difficulty with fragile beings like himself, the column shot up, exploding through the snow, where Jim tumbled out into the blizzard and rolled to a stop on his back. Ugh. He thought he heard voices somewhere, but they were muted, and anyway, he wasn't sure if he was awake or dreaming. Just give me a minute, he thought. I can get up. Just fuck. Something was crunching through the snow. He wondered if the Gallorp had stuck around. Then the crunching was louder, and a tall figure wearing the Starfleet issue inclement weather gear knelt beside him. The figure pulled down their balaclava and pushed up their goggles, and there was Spock, staring down at him, gently cradling his head. Jim blinked at him, dazed, and tried to sit up. Definitely dreaming, Jim murmured. Hush, Asheam, Spock said softly. I am here. Do not move. Be still. Jim followed his directions, since he could hardly move anyway. Instead, he kept his eyes on Spock. Beautiful, miraculous Spock, who was shouting to someone else in the snow and then speaking rapidly into his communicator. Then he was lifting Jim up in his arms, carrying him. And as the transporter beam shimmered around them, for the first time since he'd beamed off the Enterprise, the raw little spot in Jim's mind, desperate to be cared for, no longer throbbed. Chapter 5. Oops, we bonded. Jim slept, and his dreams were vague. There was a presence that he knew was Spock, and it held him gentle and warm, like hot cocoa after coming in from the cold as a child. The assurance of a steady devotion, and beneath it a ferocious passion. He rested, knowing it would be there when he woke. The birthed galaxy was beginning to grow, its stars shining brightly. Is this what the bond is? Jim said. He held Spock's hand in a dream, the two of them sitting side by side on the surface of a moon, watching their galaxy. This is how you perceive it, Spock said. And what about you? Jim raised Spock's hand to his lips, kissing his knuckles. How do you perceive it? But Spock only stared out at the stars and did not answer. Spock, Jim said, you want to keep it, right? You and me? I know it was sudden, but doesn't it feel like this is how it's supposed to be? Spock did not answer, would not answer. Jim soon realized he was dreaming, and that if he woke up, Spock might answer, and the answer might not be what he desperately wanted to hear. He decided to keep dreaming for a while. It was warm and safe here, and as much as he'd always been willing to barrel into places cold and treacherous, a frightened boy deep down inside him wanted to be warm and safe. Just sometimes. Just for a little while longer. If he is stabilized, Spock said, narrowing his eyes at Dr. Mbenga. Why will he not wake up? He has been in this unconscious state for 12 hours. Mr. Spock. Mbenga met Spock's glare eye to eye. Spock had not left the sick bay since transporting Jim from Felner 2. He'd not eaten or slept, but it had only been 12 hours. Once again, he was on medical leave. Strange, Spock thought. The interplay between emotion and time. 12 hours did not seem like much when he insisted to Christine that he was not hungry, thank you, because Vulcans do not require food as often as humans. Yet it seemed interminable when it had been 12 hours since he'd glimpsed Jim's blazing eyes, bright even when he was barely conscious, pale and bloody, and too weak to stand as he lay in the snow. Jim looked marginally less pale now as he lay atop a biobed. Spock had watched as Mbenga and Christine set upon him a perfectly synchronized team, sternly reporting Jim's compromised vitals and his erratic brainwaves, cracked ribs, ice burns, abrasions, bruises, a fractured wrist. The trauma to his brain caused by psionic interference had been the trickiest to mend. Spock had clenched his hands behind his back and waited, as long as he could stand, before suggesting a mind meld once Jim's worst injuries were taken care of, because it felt as if the bond itself was demanding it. They kept putting him off. "One moment, Mr. Spock, one moment." That had been hours ago. Still, Jim was improving, so was Spock. The healer had been correct. Proximity brought great improvement, but it was not enough. Now Spock sat, arms crossed, eyes trained on Jim's face, softened in sleep. "His brain activity is much less erratic," Mbenga said, eyeing his pad. "He has been through a significant psionic trauma, but he is now stabilized. If you wish to meld with him, Mr. Spock, I think it would be all right now." Mbenga had mentioned this psionic trauma several times since first examining Jim. It cut Spock like a knife. Surely it had been caused by separation during the bond, but Mbenga was too kind to say explicitly that Spock had caused Jim so much suffering, even if he hadn't intended to. He might have questioned the wisdom of a mind meld, too, but mind melds were the life's blood of bonds. If anything, a meld should only help Jim. Spock moved his chair forward and his fingertips gently pressed to Jim's meld points, breathing deeply, projecting calm. During Ponfar, Spock had mentioned the importance of consent for mind melds, and Jim had winked at him. "Well, you're always welcome in my mind, Mr. Spock." Jim's mind did welcome him swiftly enough. Spock did not encounter resistance exactly. Yet it seemed to Spock as if he'd walked into Jim's house, only to find he was not at home. Jim's mind presented to Spock as the bridge of the Enterprise. Spock felt an odd sense of déjà vu, seeing Jim in the captain's seat. He also saw himself right there at the science station next to Uhura at communications. It was a pleasing tableau. At the same time, Spock had felt more solidly connected with Jim's mind before melding, which was odd for anyone, much less bondmates. The last time they'd melded, it had all been emotion and warmth and abstractions projected at each other that they nevertheless understood. Total openness and a wonderful mental and spiritual embrace. This was not that. "Shields holding, Captain," the other Spock said. Spock was pretty sure the shields in question were telepathic. Jim, the typically quick study, had let him in, but was also defending himself from the meld. It was difficult not to feel a little hurt by that. "Jim?" Spock said, and Jim swiveled around to look at him. "No," Jim said. He leaned on his hand, smiling knowingly. "Not really." Spock approached the captain's chair, bemused by "not Jim's" answer, and by the very deliberate visualization Jim's mind had presented. "No?" "Jim's subconscious." Jim spread his hands as if to explain. "He's resting. Believe me, he would normally give you a much warmer welcome. But his mind went through quite an ordeal on Felner II, hence the shields. Those village elders who melded with him while he was unconscious," Spock acknowledged and dismissed a swell of anger, "they entered his mind without permission. And the Palka, who spoke to him telepathically, but did not know their own strength," the subconscious said, shrugging casually. "He might have died if he had talked to them much longer. It was extremely painful for him, yet he maintained the conversation even in the face of such torment until he had negotiated that the Palka would warm Felner II themselves. You see, the drill was harming the Palka. Now, if he told you this, he might attempt to downplay his accomplishment. But as his subconscious, I have no compunction about my reasonably sized ego. He grinned in a way that showed Spock the hungry, cocky cadet Jim Kirk had once been. "Jim is all too aware of it anyway," he said in a conspiratorial whisper. "I thought he was hurt because..." Spock stopped the thought before it could continue. He could not talk about the bond here. That was certainly a conversation for Jim's conscious mind. What stellar timing. Assaulted by psionic disruption while withstanding a fresh bond separated from your bondmate. It turned Spock's stomach. No wonder Jim was putting up shields even against Spock. "I need to speak to Jim properly," Spock insisted. "Not just his subconscious. I need him to wake up." "Why would he wake up and leave all this?" Jim's subconscious spread his hands again, gesturing to the view screen, showing stars blurring by, and the other Spock busy at his console. "He's got his fondest dream. All that out there, and all this in here." "It is not true," Spock insisted. "It is not real. He is aware of that. Jim is not someone who will be satisfied with self-delusion." Jim's subconscious gave him a long look. "You two share the rarest kind of connection. Something to be both cherished and written about in history books. But it is new. You don't know everything about him. What he has seen and lived through. You don't know the beginning of his bravery. You must allow him this moment to rest. Let him live here for a moment where everything is just as he would like it to be." "That is not unreasonable," Spock said, "after what you have told me." "That's not to say you shouldn't stick around a while, Spock." The subconscious batted his eyes. "I don't think you know just how welcome your presence is here, despite the defenses. He can breathe again. He feels held." Spock's physical body blushed. Wherever Jim's conscious mind hid, it could likely feel Spock's adoration. "I cannot stay," Spock said regretfully. "If what you say is true, we must contact the Farragut immediately. Even now, they are planning to move the drill on Felner 2 again. They don't know about this negotiation Jim arranged." The view of space flickered, and another Jim appeared on screen, frowning. "Spock, it's me. You say they're moving the drill?" "Your mission was not completed," Spock said, "as far as they are aware." Jim ducked his head, grimacing. "And the rest of the away team?" "Their shuttle crash-landed in the ion storm," Spock said. "No one was badly injured. They returned to the Farragut, and your people were organizing a search for you when we arrived on the Enterprise, but I was able to find you first." "Good," Jim nodded, "but I have to talk to Lula. I promised the Palka we wouldn't drill there again. I'm ready now, Spock. Break the meld." It was not exactly the reunion Spock had envisioned, but there was something so admirable to Spock's mind about Jim's steadfastness of duty, his determination to keep a promise to help the planet's people. Spock nodded, and all at once he was in sickbay again, moving his hand away from Jim's face as he blinked awake.
"Spock?"
Jim murmured. His hand twitched beside him, and Spock waved over Dr. Mbenga.
"Easy, Commander," Mbenga said as Jim stirred, attempting to sit up a little. He raised the head of the biobed.
Jim ignored him, his eyes snapping from bleary to bright and trained on Spock.
"Are you a sight for sore eyes?"
Jim reached for his hand, and when Spock held it, any notion of a shield from Jim had disappeared. Spock felt everything from him he might have optimistically hoped for, including overwhelming relief and a sense of great trust.
"Of course he's here," Jim's thoughts said. "Of course he found me. I feel so much better."
"I am greatly relieved to see you awake," Spock said. "To see you at all. Do you recall what just happened in the mind meld?"
"Oh," Jim's gaze flitting around as if looking for something. I have to do something.
Oh, the Palka. I have to talk to Captain Lula.
So Dune had certainly been correct that Spock's condition would improve the closer he got to Jim. He was both physically and mentally sound, his regular mental shields in place, so he had to imagine that his current state of aggravation was entirely his own doing. However, that did not make the feeling unwarranted, given the circumstances. Jim was still talking to Captain Lula on a shared call with Captain Pike, a large pad propped up in front of the bio bed. That was not unreasonable. Normally, Spock would have been quite fascinated by the Palka, except that Jim was not yet fully recovered, according to Dr. Mbenga, and the call had been going for 30 minutes. Spock could tell Jim was overly fatigued by the set of his shoulders and the way he kept rubbing his jaw. They're very powerful telepaths, Jim said for the second time. We're going to need to find someone who can communicate with them, but it's got to be a strong telepath to withstand all that. And even then, they should bring medical personnel just in case. It sounded like something Spock would have volunteered for himself in more normal circumstances, but he had no intention of parting from Jim anytime soon. That's fine, Commander, Lula said. We have a Betazoid xenoanthropologist at the outpost. She's quite experienced in such matters.
Good.
Jim rubbed his jaw again. That's good.
Commander, Captain Lula said, there's just one more thing.
It was the fourth time Lula had referred to just one more thing, and Spock must have betrayed his exasperation because Mbenga caught his eye and nodded in agreement from his stance behind the pad. Mbenga raised his eyebrows at Pike, who cleared his throat.
Captain Lula, Pike said, interrupting Lula's question, which had something to do with the distance to the Palka from the surface. As Dr. Mbenga mentioned before, Commander Kirk has suffered several injuries and is still on the mend. I believe the Farragut Science Division, as well as Outpost 5, will be able to cover some of this information themselves, don't you?
That Jim himself did not insist he was fine, Spock knew, meant he was exhausted. Even now, he sat back quietly sipping water. Lula slightly protested with questions about when exactly his first officer would be returned to his ship. Pike exchanged a glance with Spock. Pike, Spock knew, had described the Bond situation with some help via communiques from Sodune. Lula knew very well that until the Bond was either finalized or severed, Jim needed to be near Spock or his health would suffer. Captain Pike hand-waved Lula's questions impressively and ended the call before sighing heavily and shooting Spock a sharp look.
Mr. Spock, can I speak to you for a minute?
He jerked his head toward the corridor. Jim frowned, watching them go, and said as they exited, That's very suspicious, you know. In the corridor, Pike narrowed his eyes and said, Gotta say, I'm not overly fond of Captain Lula. I say that away from Jim because I know he's serious about his loyalties.
He is.
Spock clasped his hands behind his back and said, I noticed Lula did not inquire as to Commander Kirk's health.
He didn't even ask how Jim was, Pike said, throwing up his hands.
Exactly. Spock, have you talked to Jim yet about this bonding situation?
We have not yet had the opportunity, Spock said, looking down at his feet. I have not yet informed him of the bond itself, though he has likely sensed it in some way.
He doesn't know?
He only woke up a short time ago, and we called you in immediately, Spock pointed out. I must let him rest a while. He is obviously exhausted. Then I will speak to him.
I know that either way he's going to need to stick close to you for a bit, and this is none of my business, but...
Do you want to keep the bond with him, Spock?
Yes, Spock said. He felt no hesitation in the admission.
Really?
Pike's eyebrows shot up. Is that, logical? haven't known each other very long.
I believe it is logical, Captain. I had known my former betrothed to Pring since childhood, Spock said, and we proved to be poorly matched. Our bond was healthy enough, if difficult to maintain. However, what Jim and I have created is so unique and powerful. I do not see how such concerns could be relevant. It seems to me, if we have forged something so singular by accident, I would be a fool not to consider what we might do together on purpose.
Pike tittered, shaking his head. Quite romantic of you. And do you think Jim will feel the same?
I cannot tell, Spock said.
Well, whatever you two decide, Pike said, let me know as soon as you can. You're either going to need a Vulcan healer as soon as possible or a bond-made honeymoon, and then there's the future to consider. You got the fleet captain on your side, Mr. Spock. I'll help you guys however I'm able. If that means putting off Captain Cold Fish a while longer, so be it.
Thank you, Captain, Spock said. I appreciate that very much.
Spock stayed in sick bay and did not leave for the 4 hours that Jim slept. For 2 hours, he sat in his chair and combed lab reports on his pad. Then he meditated for 2 hours. Shortly thereafter, Jim woke up looking much healthier and as determined as ever. Following 10 minutes of back and forth with Dr. Mbenga, he was released to guest quarters. Yet when he glanced at Spock with a hopeful expression, Spock interpreted it to mean they would be going to his quarters instead. They needed to discuss the bond, and Spock could not help his apprehension. Such worry was illogical. Fears of a future event did nothing to change the probability of the event occurring, and yet... By the way, Mbenga said, as Jim finally got to his feet, the Farragut's Dr. McCoy gave me a call. I don't think he's going to be very happy with you when you do return to your ship.
Ah, yes, Jim chuckled. Dr. Bones.
No, I don't suppose so.
Bones?
Spock said, raising an eyebrow. Just what I'm calling him. New doc on the Farragut, Jim chuckled. Total pain in the ass. I think I like him.
He is very good, Mbenga said, nodding. Also a decent bluff at poker, I found out. I still owe him that brandy. All right, you're released, but take it easy, please.
Jim and Spock made their way out to the corridor, where Jim looked at Spock askance.
We going to your quarters?
Yes, Spock said. I have something I must discuss with you.
I imagine it has something to do with why you came to my rescue, Jim said dryly, and not someone from my own ship.
It has, Spock said quietly.
He remained stoic all the way to his quarters, yet his mind was not on the topic of the bond. It was on the report he'd heard secondhand from the Farragut's away team as the Enterprise had approached Felner II, the report that said Commander Kirk had fallen out of a shuttle mid-flight during an ion storm. His mind was also on Mbenga's lengthy list of Jim's injuries and what Jim's own subconscious had told him. When the doors closed behind them and Jim started to stretch, looking so at home in Spock's cabin, Spock took Jim's hands in his and pulled him in closer.
You were potentially near death, Jim, Spock said.
He brushed his fore and middle fingers along Jim's in a gentle au geste. The bond tingled between them, and Jim sighed.
I know, Jim said. Heh. Can't take me anywhere.
He squeezed Spock's hand. Spock stared at him, unsmiling.
Ashayam.
I'm okay, Spock interrupted him, kissing him fiercely, and Jim wrapped his arms around him. All pretense vanished as they held each other.
I was already feeling like shit the second I left the Enterprise, Jim said, resting his forehead against Spock's.
I'm thinking it's no accident. I feel just fine again now I'm with you. As good of a doctor as Mbenga is.
It is no accident, Spock murmured.
I can Hear your heartbeat, Jim said, his voice cracking. He pressed his palm to Spock's side.
I can almost feel it like it's my own. Can you explain that?
Jim looked so apprehensive it made Spock tense up all over again.
Yes.
Spock swallowed and reached up, tracing his finger along Jim's jaw.
We have bonded. A quite unforeseen consequence of Ponfar. I have confirmed it with Sodun. The yoke, Jim whispered. So it is true. I knew it. I could feel it.
Yoke. Spock cocked his head.
The people in this village on Felner too.
Jim broke away from him, speaking partly with his hands. He crossed to the love scene and sat. They sort of melded with me.
Yes, without your consent, Spock said grimly. I do not approve of that.
Well, it did take me aback at the time, Jim said with a snort. But they meant well. They saw the bond. They have the same thing on Felner too, but they call it a yoke. Spock, I think the bond probably kept me alive when I was trying to talk to the Palka, as painful as it was.
If it protected you in any way, I am glad of it. But the reason you felt unwell was because we were separated so soon after its formation.
He sat beside Jim, turning to face him.
Be assured. If I had known there was any chance of this bond forming, I would have informed you.
I know.
Jim patted his hand, but pulled away again.
I figured.
So what happens now?
We must mutually decide whether we will keep it.
It is a lifelong commitment, Jim. To sever it once it has begun to mature would be damaging to both of us.
But it could be severed now, Jim said, frowning.
Spock felt a sharply painful sensation in his fingers at the spike of fear that ran through him, but he only nodded.
Yes, it could be. We would need to find a trained Vulcan healer as soon as possible. Sodun himself would be ideal. I believe we are only 2 days from Vulcan.
Oh.
Jim leapt to his feet again, pacing around, wringing his hands.
But, Spock, what is the nature of this thing exactly? Why was its formation unforeseen?
Because it is not a common occurrence, Spock said with vehemence.
It is not something that happens. To the extent that it has, perhaps 2 or 3 times in the recorded history of bondmates. Bonds this powerful and profound are rare enough, but to be formed by accident is even more unusual.
Spock went on to describe what the bond would be like. He wanted to be sure Jim knew the realities. Humans were certainly unused to such strong telepathic connections, and with what Jim had just been through, he deserved all the information Spock could give him.
Okay. You know, I mean, the way you talk about this, Spock, Jim spoke breathlessly when Spock was done. Something like this forming by accident kind of sounds like a 1,000,000,000-to-1 shot.
It is, Spock stood, figuratively. I am not able to calculate the exact odds.
Then, Jim grimaced, shaking his head.
Spock, I can't take this. Please say you want to keep it. Please say I'm not alone in this cause.
Yes.
And again they were kissing, this time lost to each other, the bond buzzing strongly between them.
Spock fell into Jim's mind as they embraced, though it was nothing like the meld in sickbay. It was much more like it had been during the last day of Ponfar, their minds embracing in a communion of souls. Then Spock saw in Jim's mind the way he pictured the bond.
It is a galaxy, Spock murmured. He pecked a soft kiss to Jim's lips once more, leaning back and running a hand through his hair.
That is how you see it.
A world between us, Jim said, shrugging.
For us.
It is beautiful, Spock whispered.
So, Jim said, resting his hands on Spock's hips.
we're definitely not severing. Then what happens instead?
We spend several days together, Spock said, allowing the bond to settle. I am loath to once again disrupt the business of the ship and take us both away from our work, but it is necessary.
It won't be like this forever, right? Jim said. Where we can't be apart?
Certainly not, Spock said. Once the bond is settled, we will be stronger apart than we were before its formation. We will empower each other to an extent. We must tell Captain Pike immediately. Ideally, we would spend this time somewhere off the ship, a kind of retreat, I suppose.
Heh, well, when was the last time either of us took shore leave?
As a Vulcan, I do not require shore leave to the extent that humans do, Spock said loftily. You, however...
Shore leave usually makes me restless, Jim said, rolling his eyes.
All right, well, we both have a backlog then.
Come on, let's tell Captain Pike the good news.
Ha! I knew it, Pike said over the comm 5 minutes later. I just have a feeling about you two.
Hey, Spock, take a look at this resort I'm sending over to your screen.
Spock sat behind his desk and Jim crouched down next to him as his screen filled with a promotion for a couple's resort on the planet Yaz Telka Chineti Forzapan, or as it was popularly known, Yaz. Crystal clear pools, lush gardens and hiking trails, nightclubs, sandy beaches, and luxurious overwater bungalows filled the screen. A view of the nearest metropolis, the island of Luxalia, boasted a glittering skyline.
This is Luxalon Resort on Yaz.
Now, this place caters specifically to couples and polycules, Pike reported, newlyweds, established relationships, and bondmates specifically. So they're understanding of that kind of thing. They used to sell themselves as an attraction for homesick Terrans, but they became just as popular for non-Terrans looking to experience some Terran culture far from Earth. Best of all, we can be there in just 4 hours.
Well, Jim squeezed Spock's shoulder. This sounds good to me. Bondmate honeymoon on Yaz, Spock.
It appears ideally suited to our needs, Spock said. I have no objection. Thank you for your help, Captain.
Actually, Una found it, Pike said, chuckling.
Very well. Ortegas, set a course for Yaz Telka Watsis. Set a course for Yaz, Ortegas, full impulse, and you two better pack your bags. And don't you worry about Lula, Jim. I'll talk to him.
Thank you, Jim said, before Spock ended the comm. Jim sat on Spock's desk, scratching his head.
Shoot, I don't even have my stuff from the Farragut.
You do, in fact, Spock said, smiling faintly.
We knew you would be returning to the Enterprise after all. Your things were returned once we'd rendezvoused with the Farragut at Felner 2. I believe they simply took the bag you had not yet unpacked. It is in your guest quarters.
Oh, Jim brightened. Well, that's good.
Although it has Enterprise clothes.
Not shore leave clothes.
That's fine. An excuse to do some shopping on Yaz. Tell me anything else I should know about this settling into the bond business?
It is simply spending time in each other's company, Spock said. And he breathed in as Jim moved to straddle him in his chair. We are also advised to meld with each other from time to time, but it is nothing so involved as Ponfar. Jim kissed him once teasingly, then pecked little kisses up his jaw before nibbling at his ear, and Spock hummed his pleasure.
Well, it could be a little like Ponfar, huh?
Perhaps Shorley will not be so arduous after all, Spock murmured, slipping his fingers under Jim's shirt, if it is just the two of us.
Meanwhile, on Vulcan.
Sarek did not generally appreciate interruptions during his meditations on the veranda that faced out towards Vulcan's forge. But as he had gone over his scheduled period of reflection according to Amanda's chronometer in the library, she felt no compunction about the disruption. By now, he was likely only observing the view.
"Did I tell you Spock sent me a message?" Amanda reported, hovering behind him where he sat under the portico.
"He has fared well in his time. He was able to find a suitable partner for the duration. I think Sodine's advice may have helped as well. It's tempting to ask him, but I won't pry.
Sodune, Sarek murmured.
Smoothly, he got to his feet and turned to face his wife, raising two fingers. Amanda stepped forward and met them in an gesta.
He is a bit of a radical, is he not?
By your standards, T'Pau is a bit of a radical, Amanda said, raising a knowing eyebrow.
That is humor.
Correct, Amanda nodded.
I would be more gratified to hear that Spock had procured a suitable bondmate, Sarek said, and crossed inside towards the kitchen as Amanda followed. It is most unfortunate that the betrothal with T'Pring was severed.
As in all things regarding Spock, Amanda said, smirking slightly, he will find his own way.
Clearly, Sarek said.
My husband. Amanda went about making tea, taking the kettle from Sarek's hands, because he had a habit of scalding the tea, which he would utterly deny. I wish to return to our conversation regarding a holiday for the two of us.
There has been no such conversation within the last 3 months, Sarek said.
Amanda filled the kettle and set it atop its burner, lighting the flame beneath. 3 months ago, I suggested a holiday for the two of us off-planet. You answered that I may return to the subject in 3 months' time.
I am returning to the subject. Perhaps we should again table this sub...
No, Amanda said.
No?
Victory, Amanda thought to herself. There was no reason for Sarek to repeat what she had just said. He already knew he had lost.
No, she repeated, calling attention to his slip.
You have tabled the subject twice. We have not shared a holiday together in 13 months and 6 days.
You have accompanied me on several.
Work is not a holiday, my husband, Amanda said reprovingly. She took a tin of tea from the shelf and two mugs from a cabinet. You have a human wife who requires a human vacation with her husband, and I already know your schedule is free for the next 8 standard days.
Sarek paused as if to center himself.
Very well. I must presume you have already selected an appropriate destination.
You presume correctly, Amanda said, finally smiling.
We're going to the Luxalon Resort. Agnes Telka Chinetti Forzapan.
Don't worry, I shall pack your bags for you. I know you dislike the task.
I do not worry, and I do not dislike mundane tasks. Sarek raised an gesta again, a gesture of goodwill that warmed Amanda's heart.
Perhaps a vacation will not be so arduous after all, my wife, if it is just the two of us.
Meanwhile, somewhere redacted.
Subject, where are you, dumbass?
Sibe, I'm here, you're not. See if I share the latinum I just scored off some airhead Orions with you now. They actually thought those bullshit Andorian repros were real. If you don't answer within 6 hours, I'm putting a bounty on you. XOXO, Angel.
Subject, Ray, where are you, dumbass?
Light of my life. Fantastic news. Was checking up on the fam via less than savory channels and discovered Spock is on his way to Luxalon Resort on Yaz, which must mean he has a new bondmate. I'm dying of curiosity. You've always wanted to go to Yaz, right? Even better, the old man and Amanda are going too. There's no way they're aware they will both be there. Looks like it's time for a family reunion. Grab your bikini, sweet cheeks. This is going to be a riot. Sending you coordinates. BTW. If you hit on my brother this time, I'm putting a bounty on you. Love, Sibe.
The end.